several states. Can we use similar methods to manage other desirable states, such as those involving personal achievement and professional success? When I first went to graduate school, I was among an incoming class of 6 students who had been recruited as part of an established social psychology doctoral program. A sweet guy named Alan Chaikin inspired early awe in the rest of us because word had spread of his remarkable achievement on the Graduate Record Examination, GRE, the standardized test all students have to take before applying to most graduate programs. He scored in the top 1% of all test takers around the world in each of the 3 sections of the exam: verbal aptitude, mathematical proficiency, and analytical reasoning. Moreover, he scored in the top 1% of all psychology students in knowledge of that subject. Some of us had hit such scores on 1 or 2 of the sections, but rarely 3 and never all 4. So we were ready to be consistently surprised by the level and range of Alan's intellect. And indeed we were, although not in the manner we'd expected. Alan was a smart man, but it became apparent after a while that he wasn't any smarter than the rest of us, in a general sense. He wasn't any better at generating good ideas, or spotting flawed arguments, or making perceptive comments, or offering clarifying insights. What he was better at was taking standardized tests, in particular, the Graduate Record Exam. I shared an office with him during our first year and grew close enough to ask him how he had done so stunningly well compared with the rest of our class. He laughed. But when I assured him it was a serious question, he told me without hesitation that he thought his relative success had to do with 2 main differentiators. First, he was a speed reader. He had taken a course the year before that taught him how to move rapidly through written material without missing its important features. That gave him a sizable advantage on the GRE because, at the time, it was scored in terms of the raw number of items a student answered correctly. Alan realized that by harnessing his speed reading skills, he could zip through all of the large set of items in any given section of the test and, on a first pass, immediately answer each whose solution was simple or already known to him. After piling up every easy point this way, he could then go back and address the tougher items. Other students would almost always advance from one item to the next, bogged down in the difficult ones likely to carry the twin penalties of producing incorrect answers and preventing contact with easier questions they would then never reach before time ran out. Most standardized tests, including the GRE, have since been redesigned in ways that no longer allow Alan's speed reading technique to provide a competitive edge. Hence, it won't benefit current test takers. But that's not the case for his other persuasive tactic. Alan told me that just prior to taking any standardized exam, he'd spend systematic time getting psyched up for it. He described a set of activities that could have come from a modified version of Dr. Lubomirsky's list. He didn't take up the minutes before the exam room doors opened, as I always had, notes in hand, trying to cram every piece of information I was unsteady about into my brain. He knew, he said, that focusing on material that was still vexing him would only elevate his anxieties. Instead, he spent that crucial time consciously calming his fears and simultaneously building his confidence by reviewing his past academic successes and enumerating his genuine strengths. Much of his test-taking prowess, he was convinced, stemmed from the resultant combination of diminished fear and bolstered confidence. "You can't think straight when you're scared," he reminded me. "Plus, you're much more persistent when you're confident in your abilities." I was struck that he could create an ideal state of mind for himself, not just because he understood where precisely to focus his attention, but also because, as a savvy moment maker, He understood how to do it persuasively immediately before the test. So Alan was smarter than the rest of us in a meaningful way. His was a particular type of smart, a kind of tactical intelligence that allowed him to turn common general knowledge, for example, that fear worsens test takers' performance, but earned confidence improves it, into specific applications with desirable outcomes. That's a useful sort of intelligence. Let's follow Alan's lead and see how we can do the same, this time to move others, rather than ourselves, toward desired outcomes. What's already in them? Imagine yourself as a regional school superintendent in the following predicament. Your district is applying for a large federal grant that would fund upgrading your outmoded science labs, equipment, and classrooms. But to have a chance of winning the award, you have to provide evidence that the high schools under your supervision have made recent progress in readying women students for STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics careers. A successful application would require a documented increase, compared with last year, in your female student scores on the mathematics section of a standardized test that all high school seniors must take. You are worried. Despite your best efforts in recent years, recruiting more women science and math teachers, making sure that information about STEM careers and scholarships are available to the girls as well as the boys, you've seen no increase in the female students' math scores on that standardized test. Hoping for the best, you prepare to give the crucial exam at your district's high schools in the same way you have in the past, which involves the following steps. 1. The entire senior class takes the exam simultaneously. Because all the test takers can't fit into a single room at their schools, they are assigned to one of two big rooms based on the first letter of their last names, A through L in one room, M through Z in the other. 2. In each room, the exam is monitored by several teachers chosen through a lottery drawing. 3. For 10 minutes before the start of the exam, students are instructed to collect their thoughts and anticipate how they'll handle any difficult material they think might appear on the test. 4. At the test's outset, students are required to record their name, ID number, and gender. Although each of these practices is commonly employed in mass testing programs, it would be a mistake for you to undertake any of them. Why? Because of a piece of common knowledge that you've heard your school's guidance counselors repeat. There is a societal stereotype, which many girls believe, that women aren't as good at math as men are. Research has demonstrated that almost anything you do that causes women to focus up front on this belief reduces their math performance in several ways. It increases their anxiety, which interferes with their ability to remember what they know. It diverts their attention from the test itself, making them more likely to miss vital information. And it leads them to attribute difficulty with an advanced problem to an inherent personal deficit, rather than to the complexity of the solution, which makes them give up too soon. All four of your pre-test procedures will likely intensify the unsettling initial focus among your women students. Fortunately, there is an easy, research-based fix for each. 1. Assign test takers to a room on the basis of a relevant factor, their gender, not an irrelevant one, the first letter of their last names. Why? When girls are taking a math test in the same room as boys, they are more likely to be reminded of the mathematics and gender stereotype. Thus, college women solving math problems in a room, along with college men, score worse than in a room with only other women. Notably, this drop in performance doesn't occur on tests of verbal ability, because there is no societal stereotype suggesting that women's verbal capacities are inferior to men's. 2. Don't assign teachers randomly to monitor the tests. Assign them tactically on the basis of gender and teaching specialty. Girls' monitors should be female science and mathematics teachers. Why? Evidence that other women have defied the stereotype deflates the stereotype's impact. Thus, women students solve significantly more mathematics test problems, even the most difficult ones, immediately after being exposed to instances of successful women in science and math-related fields, including the women administering the test. 3. Eliminate the 10-minute period when students collect their thoughts about how to respond to the test items likely to give them trouble, because to focus on the daunting aspects of the task will undercut their success. Instead, ask the girls to pick a personal value of importance to them, such as maintaining relationships with friends or helping others, and to write down why they find that value important. Why? This sort of self-affirmation procedure directs initial attention to an interpersonal strength and reduces the effects of threatening stereotypes. In one university physics class, women students who engaged in such a self-affirmation exercise just twice, once at the outset and once in the middle of the semester, scored better on the course's math-intensive examinations by a full letter grade. 4. Do not instruct students to record their gender at the start of the math exam, as that will likely remind female test takers of the mathematics and gender stereotype. In its place, ask students to record their year in school, which in your sample would always be graduating senior. Why? In keeping with the power of mere attention shifts, that change will supplant a persuasive focus on a perceived academic shortcoming with a persuasive focus on a perceived academic accomplishment. When such a procedure has been tried, it has eliminated women test takers' math performance deficits. Of all the demonstrations of how steering attention from one feature of a person's inner geography to another can affect performance, I have a clear favorite. Besides the belief that women don't do well in math, there is the belief that Asians do. Prior to a mathematics test, researchers asked some Asian American women students to record their gender. Others were asked to record their ethnicity. Compared with a sample of Asian American women students who weren't asked to record either characteristic, those who were reminded of their gender scored worse, while those reminded of their ethnicity scored better. At one level, certain of the persuasive effects I've described in this chapter seem hard to believe. That just sitting at a particular desk before beginning to write made me write better. That adorning a conference room with selected photos prior to a meeting led to higher quality work. That having women students first write about a seemingly unrelated personal value increased their physics grades. And that merely asking Asian American women to record their gender at the start of a mathematics test damaged their performance. But asking them to start by recording their ethnicity boosted their performance. The phenomena involved appear to emerge more than automatically. They seem to surface auto-magically. But as with all magic, appearances don't reflect the actual mechanisms involved, the real causes at work beneath the surface. Next, we'll take a deeper look at what those mechanisms and causes are and at how they fit within the framework of persuasion. Chapter 9. The Mechanics of Persuasion: Causes, Constraints, and Correctives. The basic idea of persuasion is that by guiding preliminary attention strategically, it's possible for a communicator to move recipients into agreement with a message before they experience it. The key is to focus them initially on concepts that are aligned associatively with the yet-to-be-encountered information. But how does this work? By what mental mechanism could a wine store manager lead shoppers to purchase more German vintages by playing German music on the store sound system, or could a job candidate cause evaluators to view her credentials as more substantial by presenting them in a weighty binder? Readied and waiting. The readiness is all. William Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 5, Scene 2. The answer has to do with a rather underappreciated characteristic of mental activity. Its elements don't just fire when ready, they fire when readied. After we attend to a specific concept, those concepts closely linked to it enjoy a privileged moment within our minds, acquiring influence that non-linked concepts simply can't match. That is so for a pair of reasons. First, once an opener concept, German music, weight, receives our attention, closely associated secondary concepts, German wine, substance, become more accessible in consciousness, which greatly improves the chance that we will attend and respond to the linked concepts. This newly enhanced standing in consciousness elevates their capacity to color our perceptions, orient our thinking, affect our motivations, and thereby change our relevant behavior. Second, at the same time, concepts not linked to the opener are suppressed in consciousness, making them less likely than before to receive our attention and gain influence. Rather than being readied for action, they get decommissioned temporarily. This mechanism, in which an open secondary concept becomes more cognitively accessible, appears to account for the consequences of a controversial, relatively recent phenomenon: video game participation. We know, from considerable research, that playing violent video games incites immediate forms of antisocial behavior. For instance, such games make players more likely to deliver loud blasts of noise into the ears of someone who has annoyed them. The reason? The games plant aggression-related thoughts in players' heads, and the resulting easy contact with those thoughts provokes aggressiveness. A tellingly similar but mirror image effect occurs after participating in pro-social video games. Those that call for protecting, rescuing, or assisting characters in the game. Studies have found that after playing such games, players became more willing to help clean up a spill, volunteer their time, and even intervene in a harassment situation involving a young woman and her ex-boyfriend. Moreover, this helpfulness is the direct result of participants' easy access to a range of pro-social thoughts that the games install in consciousness. In an interesting twist, newer research shows that sometimes violent video game play can decrease later aggressive behavior, provided that the participants have to cooperate with one another in the game to destroy an enemy. Additional details of the new research fit the accessibility account. Playing a game cooperatively, even one with violent content, suppresses aggressive thoughts. Remaining questions, surprising answers. Useful implications of this basic mechanism of persuasion come from research answering three additional questions about the reach of the process. How soon? The first concerns its primitiveness. We've seen that closely linked associations can produce impressive persuasive effects. We learned, for example, that visitors steered to a furniture store website with fluffy clouds in the background of its landing page preferred comfortable sofas, because fluffiness and comfort were related in their previous experience. How early in life can we expect an opener to create such a privileged moment? Consider the results of a study designed to stimulate helpfulness in subjects who were shown a series of photographs that included a pair of individuals standing close together. The experimenters predicted correctly that because togetherness and helpfulness are linked in people's minds, observers of these photos would then become especially helpful. Indeed, compared with other subjects who'd seen photographs of two individuals standing apart or of one person alone, those shown the togetherness images were 3 times more likely to assist the researcher in picking up some items she accidentally dropped. Although the behavior in question, helpfulness, was different, this demonstration of persuasion seems consistent with data we've already reviewed, showing that routing initial attention to a depiction of fluffy clouds leads to a preference for comfortable furniture, and that routing it to a depiction of a runner winning a race leads to more workplace achievement, and so on. 2 elements of the togetherness experiment strike me as newly instructive, though. The first got me to whistle under my breath when I read it. The study subjects, whose helpfulness tripled, were 18 months old, hardly able to talk, barely able to review or reflect or reason. Yet the mechanism involved is so fundamental to human functioning that even these infants were powerfully mobilized by it. Second, its effect on them was spontaneous. Prior exposure to the idea of togetherness sent them rapidly to the researcher's aid with no prodding or request required. Foreshadowing alert. We'll see in chapters 11 and 12 that notions of togetherness have a large and automatic impact on important forms of adult responding as well. In one set of studies, giving people cues of togetherness increased their enjoyment of working simultaneously on a task, which led to greater persistence and better performance. Thus, when unity is made focal, all kinds of desirable concepts besides helpfulness are readied for action. How far? There's a second question that, if answered confidently, would help us gauge the scope of persuasive processes. It concerns the strength of the connections involved. Can any link between 2 concepts, no matter how distant or tenuous, trigger a privileged moment for the second after the first has been brought to mind? No. There's an important limit to persuasive effects. Attention to the first concept readies the second for influence in proportion to the degree of association between the two. I experienced this personally several years ago when I embarked on a program of research designed to discourage littering in public places. Even though littering is not the worst of environmental sins, it's not trivial either. Besides the aesthetic damage it does to the environment and the health threats it creates through water pollution, fire hazards, and insect infestation, its worldwide cleanup operations cost billions of dollars annually. My research team and I were convinced that one good way to get people to refrain from littering would be to focus their attention on the social norm against littering. But we wondered what the effect on littering would be if we used, as openers, other social norms distant by varying amounts from the anti-littering norm. Discovering the answer wasn't hard to arrange. A preliminary survey revealed 3 social norms that people rated as close to, moderately far from, and far from the norm against littering. They were, respectively, the norms for recycling, for turning off lights to conserve energy at home, and for voting. The next step was much more interesting. We went to a public library parking lot and put a handbill on the windshield of each car. At random, the vehicles got a handbill with 1 of 4 messages. 1, against littering. 2, for recycling. 3, for turning off lights. And 4, for voting. As a control group communication, we included a fifth handbill that contained a message that didn't refer to any social norm. It promoted the local arts museum. When the owners returned to their cars and read a handbill, we watched to see if they dropped them on the ground. The behavior pattern we observed could not have been clearer. A message focusing people specifically on the anti-littering norm best equipped them to resist the tendency to litter. But directing their attention to opener concepts progressively distant from the anti-littering norm made them less able at each remove to resist that impulse. Just as these results are straightforward, so are their implications for optimal persuasion. The strength of the association between an opener concept and a related concept will determine the strength of the persuasive effect. Therefore, an aspiring persuader wishing to prompt an action, helping, let's say, should find a concept already associated strongly and positively with the action. Togetherness would be a good choice. And bring that concept to mind in potential helpers just before requesting their aid. How manufacturable? But there is another approach that doesn't require finding a strong existing connection. In fact, it doesn't require an existing connection at all. Rather, it involves creating a connection from scratch. Advertisers have been using the tactic for more than a century. They present something that attracts their target audience. A beautiful vista, a good-looking model, a popular celebrity. And then link it to the product through nothing more than a simultaneous presence inside the ad. There, observers of advertisers' handiwork might experience, and indeed have experienced, a connection between Tiger Woods and Buick, Beyoncé and Pepsi, Brad Pitt and Chanel No. 5, or, unsettling to me, Bob Dylan and Victoria's Secret. The hope, of course, is that viewers' attraction to the celebrity will transfer to the product by virtue of the now extant connection. There is little need to belabor the advertising industry's use of this approach. Almost everybody is aware of what its practitioners are attempting. But besides the fact that the device works nonetheless, the takeaway here is that an effective linkage between concepts doesn't have to be located in prevailing reality. It can be constructed. The concepts only have to be experienced as linked directly in some way for the subsequent presentation of one to prepare the other for pertinent action. Recall that for Pavlov's dogs, there was no natural connection between the sound of a bell and food. Indeed, there was no link of any sort until the two were experienced as occurring together. After enough of these pairings had strengthened the connection, ringing the bell spontaneously readied the animals, via salivation, for the act of eating. The evidence is overwhelming that, like Pavlov's dogs, we can be susceptible to such strategically fashioned pairings and just as clueless about our susceptibility. For instance, to the delight of advertisers, simply superimposing a brand of Belgian beer 5 times on pictures of pleasant activities, such as sailing, water skiing, and cuddling, increased viewers' positive feelings toward the beer. Similarly, superimposing a brand of mouthwash on pictures of beautiful nature scenes 6 times led observers to feel more favorable toward the brand right away and still more favorable 3 weeks afterward. Subliminally exposing thirsty people 8 times to pictures of happy versus angry faces just before having them taste a new soft drink caused them to consume more of the beverage and to be willing to pay 3 times more for it in the store. In none of these studies were the participants aware that they'd been influenced by the pairings. If, when, then plans. The recognition that persuasive associations are manufacturable can lead us to much personal profit. even if we are not savvy advertising copywriters or renowned Russian scientists. From time to time, we all set objectives for ourselves, targets to hit, standards to meet and exceed. But too often, our hopes go unrealized as we fail to reach the goals. There's a well-studied reason for the difficulty. Although generating an intention is important, that process alone isn't enough to get us to take all the steps necessary to achieve a goal. Within health, for instance, we translate our good intentions into any type of active step only about half the time. The disappointing success rates have been traced to a pair of failings. First, besides sometimes forgetting about an intention, let's say to exercise more, we frequently don't recognize opportune moments or circumstances for healthy behaviors, such as taking the stairs rather than the elevator. Second, we are often derailed from goal strivings by factors, such as especially busy days, that distract us from our purpose. Fortunately, there is a category of strategic self-statements that can overcome these problems persuasively. The statements have various names in scholarly usage, but I'm going to call them if-when-then plans. They are designed to help us achieve a goal by readying us, one, to register certain cues in settings where we can further our goal, and two, to take an appropriate action spurred by the cues and consistent with the goal. Let's say that we aim to lose weight. An if-when-then plan might be, if, when, after my business lunches, the server asks if I'd like to have dessert, then I will order mint tea. Other goals can also be effectively achieved by using these plans. When epilepsy sufferers who were having trouble staying on their medication schedules were asked to formulate an if-when-then plan, for example, when it is 8 in the morning and I finish brushing my teeth, then I will take my prescribed pill dose, adherence rose from 55% to 79%. In one particularly impressive demonstration, hospitalized opiate drug addicts undergoing withdrawal were urged to prepare an employment history by the end of the day to help them get a job after their release. Some were asked to form an if-when-then plan for compiling the history, whereas those in the control group were not asked to do so. A relevant if-when-then plan might be, if when lunch is over and space has become available at the lunchroom table, then I will start writing my employment history there. By day's end, not one person in the control group had performed the task, which might not seem surprising. After all, these were drug addicts in the process of opiate withdrawal. Yet at the end of the same day, 80% of those in the relevant if-when-then treatment group had turned in a completed job resume. Additionally impressive is the extent to which if-when-then plans are superior to simple intention statements or action plans such as, I intend to lose 5 pounds this month, or I plan to lose weight by cutting down on sweets. Merely stating an intention to reach a goal, or even forming an ordinary action plan, is considerably less likely to succeed. There are good reasons for the superiority of if-when-then plans. The specific sequencing of elements within the plans can help us defeat the traditional enemies of goal achievement. The if-when-then wording is designed to put us on high alert for a particular time or circumstance when a productive action could be performed. We become prepared first to notice the favorable time or circumstance, and second, to associate it automatically and directly with desired conduct. Noteworthy is the self-tailored nature of this persuasive process. We get to install in ourselves heightened vigilance for certain cues that we have targeted previously, and we get to employ a strong association that we have constructed previously between those cues and a beneficial step toward our goal. There are certain strongly motivating concepts that communicators don't initially need to make ready to influence an audience through persuasion. These concepts have been previously primed for influence. By analogy, think of almost any computer program you use. It is likely to contain transfer links to desired sources of information that you need to click twice, once to ready the link and once to launch it. But the program also likely contains links that launch with just one click because they have already been readied, that is, hyperlinked to the desired information. The effect of hyperlinking to a location has been labeled by web browser engineers as prefetching it. Just as the designers of our information technology software have installed rapid access to particular sources of information within our computer's programming, the designers of our lives, parents, teachers, leaders, and eventually we ourselves, have done the same within our mental programming. These prefetched sources of information have already been put on continuing standby in consciousness so that only a single reminder cue, click, will launch them into action. This recognition highlights the potential usefulness of if-when-then plans for accomplishing our main goals. These goals exist as prefetched sources of information and direction that have been placed on standby, waiting to be launched into operation by cues that remind us of them. Notice again that the form of if-when-then plans puts the specification of those reminders in our own hands, so that we are likely to encounter them at a time and under a set of circumstances that work well for us. When it is 8 in the morning and I finish brushing my teeth, even seemingly intractable bad habits can be improved as a result. Chronically unsuccessful dieters eat fewer high-calorie foods and lose more weight after forming if-when-then plans, such as, if-when I see chocolate displayed in the supermarket, then I will think of my diet. Especially for goals we are highly committed to reaching, we'd be foolish not to take advantage of the persuasive leverage that if-when-then plans can provide. Correction. Minding the gap. To this point, we've covered a lot of data showing that 1. What is more accessible in mind becomes more probable in action, and 2. This accessibility is influenced by the informational cues around us and by our raw associations to them. The section on if-when-then plans and the chapter on the geography of influence provided welcome evidence that we can derive higher-order benefits from these elementary processes. We can do so by engineering into our everyday settings cues to actions associated strongly with our greater goals. But is this sort of tactical alignment with primitive mental mechanisms our only protection against their potential downsides? After all, it's not possible to front-load every situation we face with cues likely to take us in desirable directions. We frequently enter physical environments and social interactions for the first time. We often get carefully crafted persuasion appeals whose components we can't anticipate. In those cases, will we be leaves in the wind, blown here and there by powerful associations to the cues we happen to encounter? The answer depends on whether we've noticed the breeze. It stands to reason that if our preferences and choices can be swayed unduly, at times by cues as immaterial as whether a business has a slogan that rhymes or a name that's similar to ours, or an ad featuring a beautiful vista, or a stock market symbol that's easy to pronounce, we'd want to be able to correct for those biases in our transactions with that business. Doubtless, we'd want to correct for such influences generally, whenever they stood to bias our judgments and dealings. There is some encouraging news in this regard. Often, Simply recognizing these undesired influences will be enough to block their effects. That recognition can come to us in more than one way. Mere reminders. We all know that when we are in a good mood, the people and items around us seem better somehow. After passers-by on the street received a mood-enhancing free gift of high-quality writing paper, they rated their cars and TVs as working better. We also know that fine weather lifts our spirits and thus can produce unwarranted judgments of this type. One study showed that a man who complimented young women and then asked for their phone numbers to arrange a date was considerably more successful when he asked on a sunny morning versus a cloudy morning, 22.4% and 13.9% success rates, respectively. Sunny days don't just inflate how we feel about what we own and the people we meet. They do the same for how we feel about our lives. Individuals surveyed by phone reported themselves 20% more satisfied with their existence as a whole when asked on sunny days compared with rainy days. Hence, the unappealing leaf in the wind, and it appears rain, label, looks to fit our species lamentably well. Fortunately, there's an optimistic side to the findings. The label's fit differed dramatically when respondents were reminded of the weather before the survey began. If the interviewer asked first, "By the way, how's the weather over there?" the sunny versus rainy day effect didn't materialize at all. Simply being focused on the weather for a moment reminded the survey participants of its potentially biasing influence and allowed them to correct their thinking accordingly. Besides the comforting evidence that we are not so slavishly subject to the pulls of primal processes, there is another implication of this particular result that's worth consideration. It took only a simple, short question to eliminate the bias. In their book, The 776 Stupidest Things Ever Said, Ross and Catherine Petras include some statements that clearly belong on that list. For example, "And, what is more, I agree with everything I have just said." Pete Kornhoff, former South African ambassador to the United States. Another, "I've been traveling so much I haven't had time to grow a beard." Bob Horner, former Major League Baseball player and former student at my home university. But the authors also place in their collection a quote from Hollywood director Gregory Radoff, who said, "Let me ask you a question for your information." Although the book's authors consider Radoff's quote nonsensical, I disagree. Posing a question can provide invaluable information to its recipient. It can spur him or her to bring to mind a piece of possessed knowledge, not high in consciousness at the time, but that, when made focal, changes everything. For instance, the awareness that on sunny days we don't just wear dark-colored glasses, but rose-colored ones as well. In the realm of self-correction mechanisms, then, we can find another source of validation for a core tenet of persuasion. Immediate large-scale adjustments begin frequently with practices that do little more than redirect attention. Signs of stealthy, persuasive intent. A nudge too far. Standard product placements, the sneaky insertions of consumer products into the plot lines of movies and TV shows, have been with us for a long time. Hollywood studios have had official offices negotiating such placements and extracting a charge for close to a century. Likewise, television producers have been getting paid for decades by merchandisers who want to see characters depicted using their goods and services. The pay in this pay-for-play arrangement is especially high for well-liked actors or admired fictional figures. In those cases, considerable amounts of money are contracted for the right association. A popular character reaching for a Coke or driving a Lexus or eating a Snickers. The market for such fabricated linkages has burgeoned into the billions in recent years, with the majority of broadcast advertisers currently using the practice, and multiple product placement agencies emerging to handle the business that now flows into the production of music, stage plays, and video games. So it's clear that advertisers believe that product placements and the associations they create work. They're right. But perhaps not always in the way they suspect. A belief among many product placement practitioners is that the more perceptible the constructed connection, the more effective it will be. This view stems from the seemingly inescapable logic that the prominence of a piece of information increases the chance that audience members will notice it and thereby be influenced by it. The opinion is bolstered by evidence that more prominent product placements are, in fact, more effective, as judged by the standby advertising industry measures of success, recognition, and recall, which gauge memory for what was encountered. Take, for instance, the results of a study that examined the prominence of product placements in episodes of the popular TV sitcom Seinfeld. Just as expected, the most noticeable placements, in which the brand was both shown on camera and mentioned aloud, produced the most recognition and recall compared with less obvious placements, in which the brand name was either only heard or only seen. But besides assessing recognition and recall, the study's authors did something that prior researchers had not done. They obtained a third measure of placement success that undercut conventional wisdom. From a list of brands, audience members indicated which ones they would be likely to choose when shopping. Guess what? It turned out that the survey respondents were least likely to select the products that had been inserted most prominently. It seems that the conspicuousness of the placements cued viewers to the advertisers' sly attempts to sway their preferences and caused a correction against the potential distortion. Whereas the most subtly placed brands were chosen by 47% of the audience, only 27% picked the most prominently placed ones. People recognize that advertisers' practices can influence their judgments unduly, but it's not until they are reminded of the source of the possible bias that they act to rebalance the system. In this instance, the reminder took the form of a nudge too far, an overly exposed version of the trick of fictionally established linkages at play inside product placements. Noteworthy is the operative reason that the only thing necessary to trigger the correction was a reminder. It becomes evident when we deconstruct the word remind into its constituent parts. All that's required to arrange for people to act in accord with a piece of already held knowledge is to get them to put their minds on it again immediately before the act, literally to re-mind it. Sometimes the adjustments we make to counteract unwarranted influences take place without much forethought or delay. The recalibrations that occur when we are reminded of current weather conditions are a good example. Other times, the correction mechanism works much more planfully and slowly. This second kind of mechanism operates through deliberative reasoning, which can be used to overcome biases that flow from rudimentary psychological tendencies. If we go to the supermarket with the idea of purchasing healthy, nutritious, and inexpensive foods, we can neutralize the draw of heavily advertised, attractively packaged, or easy-to-reach items on the shelves by weighing our choices on the basis of caloric, nutritional, and unit pricing information on the labels. Gapping the mind. On the other hand, compared with those natural psychological responses, to select familiar, attractively presented, easily accessed options, extensive analysis requires more time, energy, and motivation. As a consequence, its impact on our decisions is limited by the rigor it requires. If we don't have the wherewithal, time, capacity, will, to think hard about a choice, we're unlikely to deliberate deeply. When any of these requirements isn't met, we typically resort to decision-making shortcuts. This approach doesn't necessarily lead to poor outcomes, because in many situations the shortcuts allow us to choose rapidly and effectively. But in many other situations, they can send us to places we didn't want to go. At least, not if we'd thought about it. When we don't have the ability to think properly, perhaps because we are tired, we can't rely on a balanced assessment of all the pros and cons to correct for an emotionally based choice we might regret later. I once attended a conference of infomercial producers. I'd assume that the sole reason they commonly place ads in late-hour slots was the lower broadcast fees charged at those times. I quickly learned differently. Although that started out as the main reason most such programming begins far into the night, there is a more important reason. The ads perform better then. At the tail of a long day, viewers don't have the mental energy to resist the ad's emotional triggers. Likeable hosts, enthusiastic studio audiences, dwindling supplies, and so on. Infomercials aren't the only context in which mental fatigue undermines considered analysis and its accompanying potential for resistance. Sleep researchers have noted that in field tests of combat artillery units, teams that are fully rested often challenge orders to fire on hospitals or other civilian targets. But after 24 to 36 sleepless hours, they often obey superiors' directives without question and become more likely to shell anything. Similarly, in criminal interrogations, even innocent suspects often can't resist interrogators' pressure for them to confess after hours of mentally exhausting questioning. That's why, although the typical interrogation lasts for less than an hour, interviews generating false confessions average 16 hours. Besides fatigue, numerous other conditions can keep people from recognizing and correcting potentially foolish tendencies. Indeed, such foolish tendencies are likely to predominate when a person is rushed, overloaded, preoccupied, indifferent, stressed, distracted, or, it seems, a conspiracy theorist. The list is too long to explore in its entirety, so let's just examine the first condition. When we are rushed, we don't have the time to take into account all of the factors at play within a decision. Instead, we are likely to rely on a lone shortcut factor to steer us. It might be the belief that, when selecting among options for a purchase, we should buy the item with the largest number of superior features. Even though we might know that relying on this single factor could lead to mistakes, when time is short, we don't have the luxury of painstakingly breaking down and assessing all the pluses and minuses. One study showed that time limitations drastically affected how viewers of camera product reports made their preferred choices. The reports compared two brands on an array of 12 features. One brand was superior on the three most important features to consider when buying a camera: quality of the lens, mechanism, and pictures. The other brand was rated superior on 8 features, but they were relatively unimportant. For example, the purchase price included a shoulder strap. When some viewers were exposed to information about the 12 features for only 2 seconds per feature, just 17% preferred the higher quality camera. The majority opted for the brand with the greater number of unimportant advantages. When other viewers were given 5 seconds per feature, the pattern changed somewhat, but still only 38% favored the more sensible choice. It wasn't until a final set of observers was allowed unlimited time to consider the feature information that the pattern reversed itself, and the majority, 67%, favored the camera with fewer but more significant advantages. Does the idea of having insufficient time to analyze all the points of a communication remind you of how you have to respond to the rapid-fire presentation of many messages these days? Think about it for a second. Better yet, Think about it for an unlimited time. Isn't this the way the broadcast media operate? Transmitting a swift stream of information that can't be easily slowed or reversed to give us the chance to process it thoroughly? We're not able to focus on the real quality of the advertiser's case in a radio or television spot, nor are we able to respond mindfully to a news clip of a speech by a politician. Instead, we're left to focus on secondary features of the presentations, such as the attractiveness of the advertising spokesperson or the politician's charisma. In addition to its time-challenged character, other aspects of modern life undermine our ability and motivation to think in a fully reasoned way about even important decisions. The sheer amount of information today can be overwhelming, its complexity befuddling, its relentlessness depleting, its range distracting, and its prospects agitating. Couple those culprits with the concentration-disrupting alerts of devices nearly everyone now carries to deliver that input, and careful assessment's role as a ready decision-making corrective becomes sorely diminished. Thus, a communicator who channels attention to a particular concept in order to heighten audience receptivity to a forthcoming message, via the focus-based, automatic, crudely associative mechanisms of persuasion, won't have to worry much about the tactic being defeated by deliberation. The cavalry of deep analysis will rarely arrive to reverse the outcome because it will rarely be summoned. A highly related question naturally arises. On which concepts, then, should an audience's attention be focused for the broadest persuasive effect? Our next chapters identify a set of seven. Part 3. Best Practices. The Optimization of Persuasion. Chapter 10. Six Main Roads to Change. Broad Boulevards as Smart Shortcuts. We've seen how it's possible to move others in our direction by saying or doing just the right thing immediately before we want them to respond. If we want them to buy a box of expensive chocolates, we can first arrange for them to write down a number that's much larger than the price of the chocolates. If we want them to choose a bottle of French wine, we can expose them to French background music before they decide. If we want them to agree to try an untested product, we can first inquire whether they consider themselves adventurous. If we want to convince them to select a highly popular item, we can begin by showing them a scary movie. If we want them to feel warmly toward us, we can hand them a hot drink. If we want them to be more helpful to us, we can have them look at photos of individuals standing close together. If we want them to be more achievement-oriented, we can provide them with an image of a runner winning a race. If we want them to make careful assessments, we can show them a picture of Auguste Rodin's The Thinker. Notice that whatever is just the right thing to say or do in a situation changes depending on what we want of others there. Arranging for them to hear a French song might get them to purchase French wine, but it isn't going to get them to become more achievement-oriented or helpful. And asking if they are adventurous might get them to try an untested product, but it isn't going to make them more willing to select a highly popular item or make careful assessments. This specificity fits with the way that successful openers operate for a communicator. They persuasively channel recipients' attention only to those concepts that are associated favorably with the communicator's particular goal. But isn't there an overarching goal common to all would-be persuaders? The goal of assent? After all, any persuasive communicator wants to spur audiences toward yes. Are there concepts that are aligned especially well with the broad goal of obtaining agreement? I believe so. In my book, Influence, I argue that there are six such concepts that empower the major principles of human social influence. They are reciprocation, liking, social proof, authority, scarcity, and consistency. These principles are highly effective general generators of acceptance because they typically counsel people correctly regarding when to say yes to influence attempts. To take the principle of authority